Hey there, welcome to another great edition of the AgriCurious podcast. Now, this is where you get to have all the conversations surrounding your food and we touch on the various topics that you are interested to know. Well, on this particular episode, we dive deep into two pressing environmental issues that are shaping conversations around health, food, and our future, PFAS and microplastics. So today, I sit down with two guests who bring unique perspectives to the table. Dr. Sarah White is a professor and a nursery extension specialist and a faculty senate president in the Department of Plant and Environmental Sciences at Clemson University. She has done a good amount of work in this space and brings a wealth of knowledge on environmental contaminants. Joining her is Masood Yazdanpana, a researcher with the Department of Agricultural Leadership, Education and Communication at the University of Georgia, whose insights connect science, communication, and the human side of how we respond to these challenges. So together today, we will be unpacking what PFAS are, their effect, how they stack up against the growing concern of microplastics. We also will talk about what consumers need to know when making food choices, what role policy should play, whether there is real cause for concern, and what the future might look like as science and society tackle these issues. So whether you've heard of PFAS for the first time, or you are curious about how microplastics could be affecting your everyday life, this conversation will give you clarity, context, and some big picture thinking on where to go from here. Be my guest and let's delve into this together. You're going to be excited about this conversation. I'm excited already. Let's do this together. And once again, I'm Dennis Bafo-Iwa, the artistic scientist, and the AgriCurious podcast is brought to you by the Lamb Lab. I will be back. So I'll first of all begin with Dr. White. So Dr. White is interesting. I mean, looking at your profile, you're a professor, extension specialist. You're also a faculty senate president. These are so many roles. Could you share with us what prompted you to pursue these roles?
So I think the faculty role is probably the easiest one to start with. As a kid, I loved plants. So I wanted to be able to work with my hands and work with plants. And that's what drove me into sort of a horticultural background. And then as I was getting my training and going to school, I then saw how we used chemicals to produce plants. And I was like, I would really love to focus on how we can use plants to remove chemicals from the environment and from water, which drove me to my current role at Clemson University, where I'm a professor in plant and environmental sciences, but I'm also an extension specialist, which is I have been hired by Clemson and the state of South Carolina to assist professional nursery growers with solving problems on farm. And it's like one of the most fulfilling aspects of my job is that I get to actually talk to people who grow plants on a day-to-day basis, and I get to see what they do, and I get to help them make more money and to have better environmental outcomes. So it's sort of a very fulfilling role for me. Faculty Senate President was more of a, I wanted to give back to my university community. And this was one role in which I have some strengths in just helping people communicate more strongly and helping get what faculty needs are and what administrative needs are at a university and getting people to talk to each other. And again, it's similar to the extension role in that I feel like that I am the communicator that helps people solve problems. And that's kind of how I view the faculty senate president role, is I'm the lead communicator for faculty, expressing what faculty need to the administration, getting that problem solved. So that's the nitty-gritty and short of it.
Well, that's exciting to know. All right, so let's delve into PFAS itself. When we say PFAS, what do we mean? What is it actually?
So when we say PFAS, we're really talking about a class of chemicals, and it's the technical name. I'm going to read it because it's easier than I always usually screw something up, but it's per- and polyfluoroalkyl substances, which is a long chemistry-based way, just basically say fluorine is in a compound and there's usually multiple fluorine ions that are bound within different compounds. And it's very stable because fluorine is a very stable compound. Why we use PFAS is because it's stable. We tend to use it as to treat clothing for being waterproof or stainproof. Fabrics the same way. Nonstick coatings on pans. Probably the one that causes a lot of our environmental contamination is like firefighting foams at both commercial and military-based installations. Those type of things. But what it is, it's a very stable compound that doesn't degrade, which makes it really good because it has longevity for the application that it's used for. The problem is that once it's used for that application and it leaves that application, then it's also a very stable compound that then isn't broken down readily by any other process. So it's persistent in the environment.
Okay. Is there any difference between those and microplastics?
Yeah. Okay. So there is a difference. Plastic are a different style of polymer, it's a different material. What's interesting is plastics, again, there's a lot of different classes of them. They're also stable materials. PFAS is generally considered sort of a coating for materials. Plastic materials are generally the sort of the backbone material that actually is a structure. And so when we talk about microplastics and plastics, microplastics are usually derived when larger plastic particles start to degrade or they're out in the environment. The example that's probably the easiest to give is if you think of you have a kid's play bucket that you that's perfect. You can, you know, haul sand at the beach and things like that. But as soon as you put it outside and leave it outside for a year, as soon as you go to pick it up the next year, chances are it might shatter when you try to pick it up because the sun. So even though it looked like it was intact and no degradation had occurred, the sun and UV degradation have been working on it and it will break down because as soon as light and temperature and moisture start hitting plastic-based materials, typically they will start to degrade. And so microplastics are derived from that. And microplastics, interestingly enough, are in almost everything that we use on a, or I should say plastics are on, are in everything that we use almost on a daily basis, including our clothing. So like my shirt right now, this is a microplastic, but what's also interesting is that it's, if it was a waterproof shirt, it would also have PFAS on it because PFAS is that waterproof coating. So they're connected. But so when microplastics escape into the environment, their surface chemistry and their surface composition is such that PFAS could bind to that. And then that microplastic becomes a carrier that helps the PFAS move because PFAS is a, it's a relatively large compound. They have very interesting chemistries that they don't necessarily want to stay in water, but they also may not partition to soil or whatever. So they're a very interesting chemistry depending upon the particle size and which particle exactly we're talking about. And when we say PFAS, and I'm talking about this, there's like 1,400 to 14,000, there's an order of magnitude difference here, different types of compounds that are there. And they're all just like one little molecule difference in their composition.
Mm. It seems to me that PFAS has existed all this while, but it also sounds to me like it's a new word. Did it just appear from nowhere or is something that has existed over time?
It was first sort of invented or found back in the 1940s. Okay. So it's not, and sort of plastics have probably about the same timeline. And both of these, as we started expanding our sort of industrial chemistry techniques to make compounds with better purposes or make things that improve everyday life for humans. We've also had the unintended side effects or consequences of creation of new compounds that have not existed for thousands of years. And then there's not like microbial communities adapted to help degrade them or transform them or take them out of the cycle. So we have started developing a new sort of life cycle for these type of chemicals.
So is that a reason why they're called forever chemicals?
Yeah, it really is because of their stability. They don't degrade. Microbial communities don't degrade them. It's very hard to remove them. Even if you do get one, like one fluorine bond to break by some process, you still have another 8 to 10, the whatever number of fluorine sort of compounds on them. So they're just there because they're stable, because fluorine is not readily available out in the environment, the natural environment. It's not. So once we started inserting them into compounds, the microbial communities have not adapted to availability of fluorine yet. So it may be that in the future we do have, you know, microbial communities that can degrade these, but they're not right now.
Okay. Masood, hearing something like forever chemicals, for me, when I hear forever chemical, it sounds very kind of alarming to me. Should we be afraid?
Definitely the response for this question is yes, because it's included in the, our environment, like the wind, like the body, like the soil, like the water. And through that elements of the environment, we find its way to our body. And it's caused many problems for human alongside of the human, I think this type of the products cause many problems, as a bunch of the literature over there about the its impact on the environmental, economic, and even social part of the, our society. So if we have should most conscious about these petro-human chemical objects. However, I have to say, without plastic, our combat to the food security hunger not possible, because plastic cause we boost our production. And in the current situation, we, through the assist of the plastic and the material we made with that, we have a huge progress in agriculture production and even in others, like other sectors. However, it's only the white coin or white side of the plastic coin. Unfortunately, the other coin, it's very, very, very dangerous. And we should care about it in very high alarming situation.
Okay. Thank you, Masood, for that. But then I also want to find out, Dr. White, you are in, say, the nursery sector. Let me put it out, an extension specialist. Now, how do we find this PFAS enter into our agricultural systems, say the soil, water, plant, and then how can they make their way to the food that we consume? Are there any specific materials that you use that are very prone to having PFAS seep into these things that I just mentioned?
So in reality, it's kind of important to just, you know, take a step back and think about how PFAS actually gets into our world, where it could actually interact with our agricultural system, because it's a man-made product or man-created product. So in thinking about that, the most ways where PFAS is found, it's found in groundwater near sites that have either been manufacturers or producers where they were discharging product, or again, in near airports or military applications. That is the most common place where concentrated quantities of PFAS can be found. And it typically is in the water system, although it can, but they found PFAS in the Arctic as it's moved in particulate that has then deposited into the ice. So, I mean, PFAS is everywhere now. It's not something that's just contained to where people are. It's in very remote, very rural areas. So groundwater is one way that we can get PFAS into our soils and our production systems and agricultural systems. Land application of sludge, which is like byproducts of wastewater treatment, where, you know, where industrial wastewater may be going into that system or others. That is another location where farmers may introduce or may have a potential to introduce PFAS contamination to their site simply because they're trying to do something which is considered better for the environment by using sludge or an animal byproduct or waste product to help fertilize their soils. So there are some trade-offs to some of these things. And one of the recommendations from USDA related to land application of sludge now is to actually have testing so that you know if PFAS is or is not present, because they've actually had instances, I believe it was in Texas, where they land applied sludge and then they had effects on their livestock production because of the sludge that was produced, because the PFAS levels were so high, where their animals were actually having mortality events. So this is not something that you want to play with. This is not something you want to guess about. This is something you want to be knowledgeable about. So when you water a plant, and every plant that you need to grow has to have water on it at some point in time. If you're in using rain-fed agriculture, chances of contamination from PFAS are pretty low. If you're in irrigated agriculture using water from groundwater, chances of PFAS contamination depend upon your proximity to a site that had PFAS contamination. So realistically, you can, like, if you're really curious and you want to look at this, you can look at some PFAS contamination maps like the U.S. Geological Service has, and you can kind of see hotspots. And it's typically around cities and industrial areas, or again, around military bases. I think I answered part of your question. If we want to translate to, is there risk for it to get into food? Frankly, yes. And it can be, I mean, because it does get into the soil, the plants will absorb it, they will take it up, and it will be fixed within the tissues. So depending upon what type of crop that we are talking about that we're growing, or if we're doing hydroponic production in a greenhouse and our water is contaminated with PFAS, there's definitely opportunity for PFAS to be within the food crop. And there are instances where it has been measured and recorded that it's been like in tomatoes and some other things like that. So there is reason to at least be aware of the potential for this, but it is not everywhere. And typically the concentrations are relatively low. However, I will say the EPA's new criteria for concentrations in drinking water are at like 4 nanograms per liter or parts per trillion. And so 1 part per trillion is you put 1 drop of water into 20 Olympic-sized swimming pool to give you just like, so it's like 1 molecule in 20 Olympic-sized swimming pools. So if you had 4 molecules of PFAS in 20 Olympic-sized swimming pools, that is what the EPA is now considering safe for human consumption. And it used to be 70 parts per trillion. So there's some real, like, we've gotten much better at detecting it, which is the good thing, because we're figuring out some of the problems of how do we detect it? How do we know if it's there? Detecting it in water is tricky, but detecting it in soil or from tissues, whether they're plant or animal, gets it to a whole nother level of just challenge. So EPA is in the current process of like validating methods to make sure that anything that is detected is a reliable or standard method is what the term I'm looking for. They're developing standard methods for PFAS for about 40 different PFAS contaminants that can be detected in water.
So can we say that in agricultural practices where we use a lot of plastics, you know, and a lot of synthetic fibers or materials to help nurse seedlings and all of that, we could be prone to PFAS?
Just because it is plastic does not necessarily mean that PFAS is going to be a contaminant that's going to be associated with it. Those two are not synonymous. They're not synonymous. It's not just because you have one, you're going to have the other. So that's not the case. But the challenge with most of our agricultural production systems, the intensive ones where we're using plastics, whether it's for ground cloths or weed control or greenhouses, as Masood was talking about earlier, or the variety of these applications, is that again, as UV light hits them and as water runs over them, they start to degrade and they become, so you're getting the microplastic release. And that's when you have microplastics that could potentially then bind with any chemicals that have been used on site and then transport those chemicals off farm as the water actually leaves the farm. So that's where your opportunity is to have unintended consequences of application. Now, what the interesting thing is, if I'm putting my nursery extension specialist hat on, I think there's opportunity to use some of our nursery production systems to clean water and maybe help remove PFAS from water. Because if we're talking about the nursery production and ornamental crops, those are crops that we're not intending to eat, that humans will not eat, and that most of them aren't even, you know, having berries that wildlife will eat. So it may provide an opportunity to actually help remove some of the PFAS from water before it ever leaves farm. That is my conjecture. That is some of the work that I would like to do in the future. So that is not something that's definite. But since we know that PFAS can accumulate in other crops and in some of the foods that we eat, it seems likely that we could use plant production to actually help remediate some of this problem.
Okay. Masood, would you want to add anything to this?
So thanks to Dr. Wright. I think it's very important in whole segment of the hierarchical system of the society, like the micro, meso, micro, and even international, we think about that. And as Dr. White truly confirmed that, it's a worldwide problem. It's not, we can say, okay, it's belong to this part of the world. For example, if a piece of plastic through the water convey to the Persian Gulf in the Iran, maybe a people in the Australia or the North America or Canada eat the fish who contain the plastic or microplastic. So it's a concern across the world, and through that, we should take concern about that, particularly in the micro level, the awareness and the spreading knowledge about the problem, about the danger of or threat of the plastic, it's very, very important to make people cautious about the use of the plastic. And in the meso, micro, and even international level, it's very important to design a liable policy to help and also support people to use less plastic, because most of the plastics come from the consumption of the plastic in every sector, like the farming sector, like the human daily life and other part of the like building and other sectors. So it's very, very important to reduce the impact of the plastic started with their knowledge, awareness, risk perception plus the good policy. For example, I saw a very good policy in Germany. When you go to the supermarket to buy some things, for example, the water bottle or some things, you have to pay extra money for every bottle of water. When you bring it back to the supermarket, they bring the money back to you. It's a very, very, very simple policy. But I think it's helped we reduce the amount of the plastic if dispersed in the whole of the society. So as I again will emphasize, the awareness, increasing the awareness and knowledge about the impact of the plastic in the society, environmental, economic, and social part of our society is very important to make increase citizen risk perception. However, it's not definitely enough. The policymaker has many things to encourage, both through the technical aspects of a new innovation, or maybe we say the more modernized products, and also other type of the policy to encourage people to less use plastic.
Right. So, Masood, you have spoken much about policies with regarding plastics and so forth. Dr. White, I would want to know from you if there are existing regulations or guidelines to protect, you know, especially agricultural systems from PFAS. And again, also setting out the difference between PFAS itself and then the plastics and how these regulations impact each other separately.
So realistically, there are not regulations limiting the concentration of PFAS that can be found on farm. What's interesting is if you take a, as I did this morning in preparing for this discussion, if you take a deep dive into the USDA website and look at their PFAS stuff, they're like, how did PFAS get there? And then into farms, into plants, animal, that kind of thing. And then what can we do about it? The European Union, with their precautionary principle, has been much more forward thinking in terms of how and has not allowed PFAS in their associated, that whole class of chemicals, since 2016. The U.S. just started limiting concentrations in drinking water in 2025. This year was when they officially enacted it. And and drinking water plants have 4 years to change practice and to make sure that their treatment processes adequately remove PFAS from water. In the land side of things, since PFAS can interact with soil and particles as well as water, there are more factors that can influence sort of just bioavailability of PFAS. So what they do encourage for farms, since it's either water-based exposures or biosolid-based exposures, is that if you're going to, again, apply biosolids, get it tested before those applications are made so that you know if PFAS are present in that. If they are, you don't want to accept that material on your farm because, again, it is a forever chemical and it is really hard to get rid of. Even in drinking water, there are not that many treatment processes that actually remove it. If you translate that into soil-based systems, it is even harder to remove. And I mean, like, and one of the disposal mechanisms, so you have three drinking water, and then I think there's realistically two reliable ways to remove it from like soil-based systems, which is disposal into a permitted landfill or incineration. Drinking water is carbon filtration, ion exchange, or reverse osmosis. So there's not a lot of processes out there that completely remove and then destroy that PFAS compound. That's that next phase of research that like the Department of Defense is really interested in this. Like, so we know we have a problem and we can remove it, but then we have another contaminated material. How do we destroy it? And that's where we're headed, or where they are headed in their research realm. And I know I really talked around your question. Did I even remotely answer your question?
Yeah, I think you did. You did. So what I'm learning from this conversation here is that PFAS are chemical contaminants, as we know, and then plastics may be more like a physical contaminant, but then PFAS can bind to microplastics or plastic surfaces, all right? So I think that is where we need to perhaps draw the difference. that PFAS itself may not be the plastic itself, but then it has a higher capacity or tendency to bind to these plastic surfaces. And when you come to nurseries, especially in agriculture, we use a lot of plastics. Don't you think it's about time that we actually review some of the practices we use in agriculture, you know, pertaining to plastics and all of that? And I'll begin with you, Masood, what you think about this in our nurseries and agricultural productions, the use of plastics, the use of some of these materials that PFAS can actually bind to, especially if you go to some places, they use water from the ground, which they have not tested. We could have some PFAS in there and they will end up in our food. Masu, do you think there should be a way to review our practices in agriculture to be able to detect some of these things? So that in as much as they may be negligible in human food or in the human body, we still will be doing a good job trying to prevent them altogether.
I think as Dr. White says already, it's really hard to disconnect this from our food unless we're forbidden the application of the plastic. However, I think it's a trade-off between the production of the food and the health. So which one is more significant or more important for humanity? I think in the current situation, people say, okay, we will leave. Then if you think about how we can be healthy, maybe in the near future, the scientists find a new innovation to remove that from the food. I think it's a very important trade-off between what we want to, and definitely the cost of the food is a very important factor. For example, who can pay more, definitely use the produce with less use of the plastic in the process. And maybe in the 5 years later, currently we have the organic sector in many supermarkets. I predict maybe less than the 5 years later, we have some indication in the supermarket. They indicate these foods produced without the plastic with the much, much higher prices. So if I answer your question correctly, the plastic as an innovation make the more different classes between the developing and rich country and developing country. And because they can offer different type of the subsidies plus legislation and the rules to use less plastic to food. In other side, in the democracy, in this type of the country, I mean the developed country, from the citizen pressure to the government to react about this. However, for the developing country, as you know, we have many problems. Alongside of the food security and hunger, that's definitely prevent this type of the forbidden behavior or protection behavior. However, finally, I think we have to go to this way to reduce or eliminate plastic from the production. But it takes some time, very cost, very effort from both practitioners, citizens and researchers, and top of all of them, the policymakers.
Right. Thank you, Masood. So, Dr. White, I think Masood gave a good response to this. But the reason for this question is that the consumer has concerns, and usually they do not have all their concerns answered. They do not necessarily or may not necessarily understand the science behind what goes on in the nurseries, on the farms, and all of that. And so for that reason, misconceptions also spread easily. So most consumers would rather prefer to join some kind of woke movement that speak about plastics and then create all sort of misconceptions about plastics. And then it will be left to the scientists or the people that are in the science to come debunk that or give the right answers or responses to that. So when we talk about plastics, we know agriculture has used plastics over some time. Is that really a concern? Should we be worried about using that because now we feel PFAS can actually bind to that or become a part of it in our agricultural system? Or there should really not be any cause for worry? What is it actually? What are the dynamics like from where you stand?
So if I am a nursery grower thinking about the benefits, the cost-benefit analysis for plastic use on farm, PFAS isn't even in that equation.
Okay.
So because chance in most locations, PFAS contamination of plastic, other than the pesticides that are used on farm, and those are pretty minimal for most growers because they're so extensive, that's where you're going to see that. The issue is going to be, is I think where we're going to see dynamics start to change, and some growers are already looking for our alternatives to plastic for sort of the containers. We do have some alternatives for containers because that is the product that most consumers interact with the most, rather than sort of the greenhouse covering or the ground cloth. And as a consumer, as an educated consumer at this point, I am frankly probably more worried about the impacts of microplastics than I am about PFAS. That may not be an educated, but that's kind of where I, because microplastics are also everywhere. But potentially the impact of microplastics, I think it's growing at a larger rate than PFAS because we've started regulating PFAS use. However, plastic use, we really haven't touched that much. I mean, there's a few areas that have. So it's an interesting question, but the trade-offs are economics and convenience. So it's going to come down to societal pressure. Okay. Like you're not going to, as Masood said, like you're going to have the policy-driven side of that coin. And something else I was reading, they consider policy sort of the tailwind to change. It's the consumers becoming aware that this is an issue and pushing for change that actually starts to drive change of behavior in industries or the nurseries. So we're seeing the more progressive growers really actively looking for alternatives to plastic in as many places as is practical. It's only when you're going to have either societal pressure or regulatory pressure, which means they're going to have fines if they don't change it, that you're going to start to see those who are reluctant to change actually change practice. Because for the most part, consumers aren't that willing to change to pay more for the product, unless they understand why they should pay more for a product produced using a different technology, because a lot of the plastic alternatives are more expensive on a per unit production. So it comes down to the economics of it and who is willing to pay for that change in practice.
Interesting. My next question is, if you know any unanswered questions that are really significant in the science of PFAS and microplastic in agriculture, is there something you know that you feel consumers really want answers to, but these answers are not there? Maybe there's not been research enough to give the responses.
I would actually say for both PFAS and microplastics that there are a lot of unknowns about how bad they are for human health or environmental health. Just because we can measure it doesn't mean it's problematic. Okay, so that's my first sort of statement. Science communication is really hard because a lot of times what we talk about is really complex. And we always say, it depends, maybe, we think, because we labor under that. We're 95% sure this is true, but there's that 5% opportunity that we're wrong, okay? So I would say the biggest problem is sometimes in the past, science have said, this is really bad, and people have changed, and it wasn't. So people spent a lot of money to solve a problem that they really could have left alone. So a lot of scientists are working to actually ask better questions. And so for both microplastic accumulation in the environment and PFAS, yeah, we know there are human health effects for PFAS. It's concentration-based gain. So it depends on how much you're drinking on a given day, how much water you're drinking or how much food you're drinking as to how much is going to accumulate in your body. Microplastics, it's the same thing. Both of them can get into your brain. It's a very interesting question in terms of potential impacts, but it comes down to sort of a toxicology principle in that the dose makes the poison. So it's how much you have to consume to actually have an effect. And that's where even EPA acknowledges that there's not that much information on what that dose is. While they have set very, very low detection maximum contaminant levels for drinking water, that's out of very precautionary, but it's also probably somewhat educated based on some toxicology testing on how much did one have to consume to actually have a neurologic or a reproductive effect or cancer or any of those things in usually a mouse model organism. So it's really confirming how bad it is And then again, with like, you know, arsenic is bad, but it binds to other things. And how available is it? Those are the same kinds of questions we're asking for the PFAS compounds and the other compounds, is like, just because it's present doesn't mean that it's bioavailable, and how bad is it? And so those are the kind of questions that we're trying to answer. Now, I mean, ideally for a consumer, you could have a stamp that says certified PFAS free. But I mean, so if we think about some clothing companies are going to say, well, no PFAS was used in the manufacturing. However, if there's environmental contamination of the cotton that's used to produce the clothing, somebody could, you know, cut up one of those really, really expensive shirts and measure it and have PFAS present in the material, even though there was no additional, you know, PFAS used in the manufacturing process. So there's going to be a lot of sort of that slicing and trying to really finagle and come out with what really is problematic or not. So we want to be sure that we're telling people the truth before we mandate that they spend a lot of money to change practice when there are really not viable alternatives that allow us to produce the crops that we need at the levels and at the cost that helps support a society. And I think Masood's point on that was really, really pertinent, is having food is probably more important in some instances than having food that's not contaminated with PFAS. And that's kind of hard for like our American society to say, but it's a really important distinction that I think we need to be aware of when we're saying we shouldn't use plastics at all. There are reasons that we have started using plastics. Maybe we could find better alternatives that actually degrade and don't have the other effects, but we're aware that we need those now. And there are scientists who are working to develop those materials.
All right. Thank you. And I think one thing you said that really hit me had to be that all the answers are not known. And so this also goes down to research. And scientists also have to be honest in dealing with consumers and people. Once you do not know answers, you do not falsify results so that you're able to let them know that you're making progress with things. So yes, we will wait for the research. Masood, talking about research, let's put PFAS and plastics side by side. Aside scientists doing this, trying to find out, you know, at what rates, at what percentages, at what quantities would affect individuals or even our ecosystem or the environment, what do you think the public, the people, the consumers, what roles can they also play in addressing some of these things?
So I think first of all, as Dr. White's already mentioned about that, we should be honest as a science base with the people and public and consumer. At first, we have to inform about what's going on. Plastic probably do, as Dr. White, we will not completely sure, but we have some evidence that it makes some problem in whole society. So we have to be honest with them. And through the credible sources, inform them, update them, alert of them about the situation. Definitely, we can't pressure them to choose between the alternatives. However, through the awareness, through the knowledge, through the increasing risk perception, we can make them aware of the situation. In other sides, probably the plastic as a chemical, human-made production, we have to be precautious and cautious about that. Because like the other chemical inputs, it makes some problem in our society, our environment, our economy. So I think from this practitioner, from the scientific perspective, we should alarming them about the threatened parts of the plastic in our life. And this in the whole education process, from the elementary to the post-secondary and even adult learning, like the agriculture extension and education. And through these information processes, I think we can get more results from our community, our public, our consumer. And through increasing, I said, the risk perception, knowledge, awareness, we will give a lot from the public. Because people, I mean, if you look at the Maslow hierarchical needs, after they remove their basic needs, they think about the better situation. And through this process, they will think and do appropriate behavior regarding the plastic in the society.
Okay. All right. That's a good one, Masood. Put in some of these things in our educational curricula to be able to educate the public. And then that is not just a responsibility of scientists, but, you know, the public, the institutions, the schools and itself. So that's a good one. Dr. White, so oftentimes it appears that consumers or people go with most of the things that cause some sensationalism in the media space, and then they stick to it. And that is because most people would also say that scientists do not really come out to communicate with them on the good and the bad of this. And so the misconceptions travel really, really fast. And before you know, they have actually gone with that. And so now the work of the scientists becomes a double one, because now you need to make them trust you and then give them that information. How do we change this narrative? How do we get to the people to make them trust us, the work that we're doing, that it is for their benefit, so that we change that mindset where people throw in anything in the media space and then people just grab it, and then it becomes so difficult for scientists to now change the perception? Because I'm pretty sure many people have a lot of misconceptions about PFAS. And then today we're learning that the effect is not so significant, but then scientists are still trying to do their best to really understand that. How do we take information to the public in a more non-scientific way to attract, you know, their interests? How do we change this?
You know, that is an incredibly good question that if I had the answer to, you know, I would probably be rich and I would be touring again and talking to all universities and helping them solve their communication issues. But realistically, it takes somebody like me being willing to engage in the process and having the time to go, you know, to speak to media sources or to do a podcast or to interact on social media and find that, and then have the trust built in my brand or that brand to have people listen to what I say. And the problem is that most of us have limited circles of influence, is how I would probably put it. So expanding your circle of influence so that when you do speak about a topic that people trust you is that important thing. And a lot of, I would say, researchers are not incredibly good at communicating their science, and nor have they had to be good at communicating their science, which sort of leads to the disconnect that you talked about, where people aren't trusting science anymore. So it's so easy to go out and find that tidbit of information, that little piece of information that affirms what you believe already. It's really hard to go out and, you know, do what we do as scientists, which is dredge through, you know, 20 different pages and find what we actually think the answer is, or actually do experiments to find the answer. And so it's communicating that in a way, yeah, communication. And many of us are really bad at it. How do we change that paradigm? I think it's actually getting scientists to start communicating, and then having universities that are willing to help us, or training or whatever. We need better opportunity to learn how to communicate. We're taught how to do science. We're taught how to do a lot of stuff. We're not taught how to communicate, honestly. And it's a gap and a weakness in many of us. So, and it's also some of us try to avoid it, actively avoid it. So, and I'm talking about myself. I don't like communicating sometimes. So I don't think there's easy answer to your question. Right. It seems like a very obvious, you know, question with an easy answer. And frankly, it's not, because the incentive structure is not there unless our granting agencies say you must do a better job of communicating. And that hasn't really been required.
Right. So. All right. I think you're right. And many people say that the scientists, you know, they do not communicate to us. And so it makes it easy for some people just to carry some information about actually messing up the whole situation. And then scientists would now have to come and do a double work. So I think we should communicate more. Find means. This is another conversation for another day anyway. So I'll be wrapping up, but I have a few questions for you, both you and Masood. And then we can share on this and then wrap it all up on this particular session. So you working with farmers, Dr. White, what are the major concern that farmers have when it comes to food production? It may not be related to PFAS or to microplastics, but if you can share with us the major concerns that farmers that you work with have in regards to their practice.
So I would say your major concerns right now are actually labor.
Okay.
They can't afford to, they can't find and they can't pay. Or it's hard to pay what labor costs are now. So they're trying to find alternatives for that. If we, so that's the big one. Labor is the biggest the biggest issue that if any farmer that you talk to would probably tell you that is their biggest expense and it's their biggest concern. They're not sure if they'll have enough labor to even harvest their crops. So it's a really interesting and scary place to be. Next, if you were out west, water availability is your biggest concern. You don't even really care about what the quality of the water is. You care that you actually have water. They have figured out ways to work with poor quality water with high salts, other contaminants potentially for production, and it's even food production. They've just devised different ways for applying it based on whatever's present to minimize health risks associated with the use of the water. If we want to get down to sort of that PFAS microplastic mm-hmm. question, mm-hmm. unless they are in a PFAS contaminated area, they don't even know it's I'm gonna throw a number out there. Masood could totally disagree with me because we don't know this number. I'm gonna say 90% of them don't even know that PFAS exists.
Okay,
so if we want to echo that, you know.
so let's put it this way: you talked about labor. So if we should develop a scale and then put labor at the top, say at 100%, where will PFAS be?
Like 2%.
Oh,
honestly, it's not even a. Like, so I think this is one where society perception is going to really start pushing that number up. Plastics probably at 10%.
Okay.
Maybe 15.
Okay.
And those who are big enough to have extra budget are trying to find alternatives to plastic because they know consumers are concerned about plastic. Microplastics, not necessarily even on the radar. Some of them know about it. Some of the researchers, nursery extension specialists, have been doing a little bit of education in this realm. So you have some pockets of growers who are more aware than others. I think you're going to see a shift in plastics before you see a shift in concern related to PFAS, at least at the nursery and sort of vegetable production scale. If you ask dairy farmers this question, it is a whole different scenario.
Right. Right. Masood, labor at 100, plastic at 15, PFAS at 2%. What is your take on this?
So I totally agree with Dr. White, because honestly, I engage with some interview focus group. And when we talk with the farmers, they mostly were concerned about the benefits. First of all, when they talk about the plastic, somehow they aware of the plastic, about the danger of it and threat of the plastic. And finally, maybe 2% or less, something like that. They even heard about the PFAS. And this is a very, very new thing, even in the consumer situation. However, through this interview and focus group, I find very, very good things. They say, we produce based on the consumer demands. I think this is our basic equation to change the direction of the plastic and PFAS or microplastic in agriculture sector. However, we never should forget the benefits. The benefit is at first. However, without the demand, they will not reach to the benefits. So this is a triangle equation. Benefits, consumer demands, and support these two sides by government, by institution, by other agencies that could help both sides to bring them together, close together. I'm sure they will not completely attach to it together. However, we can try to gradually close them to produce better food and environment.
Okay. All right. Thank you, Masood. All right. So, Dr. White, I would give in to you for your last statement. And then I want you to, again, talk about PFAS, the distinction between this and then the microplastics. And I know that Masood did answer initially that, well, we should be concerned. But what would be your view on that as well? Should we really be afraid? Because per whatever you've given to us today, the effects are quite very minimal and there's still research ongoing. What do consumers have to think? Do they need to be rest assured that scientists like you and those researching on this have got their interest? And so there shouldn't be any cause to worry, or how do they have to go about this particular subject when it comes to PFAS microplastics?
Very good question. So in thinking about, you know, PFAS and microplastics and food contamination and need for consumer concern, realistically, I mean, there's a food inspection, safety inspection service with USDA, and they inspect and test food, and they test and see how much of X is in it, and they say whether it's safe for consumption or not. That process is ongoing for PFAS. So realistically, the chances of high concentrations of contaminated food getting into our supermarkets is quite low, at least for large scale production style things. So I would probably lean toward the, it is a concern because we know there are harmful effects for PFAS. However, awareness is half the battle on this. So if I were that person advising someone to say, this is what steps I would take so that I felt comfortable with either my water or food. And frankly, I would worry more about water than I would about food at this point in time. I would want to go to my municipality if I have a municipal water source. And this would be a grower too. And I would want to know what PFAS levels are detected in the water and what chemistries are present, because that is knowledge is power, and you can figure out if you need to do something or not. And there are filtration technologies that work. So even a grower can install filters to clean and remove PFAS from water to reduce the impact of that on that potential if that crop is going to be produced. If you are on a well, your Department of Environmental Services or Water Environmental Protection, whatever that environmental leaning branch is, or there are people who test wells and find out if PFAS contamination is in water. I actually did that myself. I contacted my local Department of Environmental Service, and because I knew my house is near a mill, an old mill site. So I was like, there's chances are that there's something in the water. They tested it. Fortunately, my wells are not contaminated, but I knew enough to ask for that, and they will provide that service. There may be a cost to it, but if this is something you're worried about, I would get it tested so then you know. And you know whether you should be worried or not. And so again, the areas where contamination is most common are those where near industrial sites where the stuff was produced, or areas where like firefighting foams were applied. So aviation areas, airports, commercial airports, or military sites are the most common. Military has since transitioned to non-fluorinated firefighting foams. So they're reducing that impact, and DOD is committed to helping clean up those sites. So they at least have a policy in place for that. So again, knowledge is power. Get tested what you can. USDA, their food safety inspection service, really does actually test different categories and types of foods to make sure that they aren't contaminated with a variety of foodborne pathogens as well as PFAS. So realistically, in the U.S., I would say that for the majority of our population, there is minimal risk of at least levels of PFAS that would cause human health effects. However, if you are in an area where that is affected, chances are, you know, it could be a waterborne exposure or something from food. Frankly, I would, and this is so counterintuitive, but I would probably worry more about a small-scale farm using irrigation water from a groundwater source and growing organic food in a PFAS-contaminated area than I would worry about a commercially produced product, just because of the limited lack of awareness of the potential for that water to be contaminated.
Right. So that's a good one, because education also matters in this. Like you rightly ended, you worry more about a small-scale farmer who is using some underground water that is contaminated than perhaps consuming something that's being produced commercially. But many people do not know this. And so usually the paradigm shifts, like we said. Masood, do you foresee, I mean, and this is going to be in addition to your ending comment, do you foresee a future where there are a lot of technologies to be able to easily and simply test for some of these things, microplastics, PFAS, in the coming years? And also your last remark on this.
Definitely your answer. I think it should be yes, because so human always working to the better situation, better innovation, and more modern society. And I think we will get there. However, I don't know when. So how long it take? But yes. However, we don't completely rely on that, because as you know, every human progress, every human innovations has good sides and also side effects. The best things to balance this situation is the public. Demand from the public and awareness and knowledgeable publics make balance this type of the progress. And as Dr. White says, yes, the knowledge is power. And when we increase the power of the society, our power of the our public, power of the, our consumer, they demand the good things. And the firms, industry, and other who serve to the public always think about the more benefits. And they have to balance between the benefits and our public demands. So I think through these elements that increase the public knowledge, they will make better demands. And these demands make the balance between the progress, new innovation, and other things for making the world better place for the life.
Okay.
I'll just say that it's ironic is that because consumers, and I will count myself as one of these, we are reluctant to change our own practices. It's very fun to point fingers at others, but microplastic and plastics are in everything that we use almost every single day. My glasses, you know, the bags that our cereals come in, which coated plastics have PFAS on them much of the time for nonstick stuff. So those single use, those convenience. So it's going to require considerable education to shift that paradigm. That knowledge gap that just because it's convenient doesn't mean it's safe. And I think that's going to be quite an education. And there's going to be companies who are reluctant to have that education out there because it impacts their bottom lines. But a lot of companies are already changing practice because they either been sued or seen another company been sued related to PFAS. Plastic litigation is not quite as common as PFAS litigation right now, just because the person who creates the plastic is not the person who disposed of the plastic. So it's a very interesting conundrum. And frankly, you know, like the difference between an essential PFAS versus a non-essential use PFAS is a really interesting dive of just like what are those and how do we change that practice? And it, again, knowledge, education, awareness. So I think that's going to be what it comes down to in the next 10 years. You'll see a shift in society once we become more educated about the unintended consequences of some of our conveniences today.
Thank you very much, Dr. White. Thank you very much, Masood.
Thank you, Dennis. This has been fun.
Okay, yeah, it has been. All right, it's been a very interesting and good conversation with both of you, and I have loved this to bit. Thank you so much for being with me and for speaking about this. Thank you so much, Dr. White and Masood, for deciding to be here to have this conversation with me. I'm pretty sure we have educated so many people out there about PFAS and microplastics, and I have learned a lot. I appreciate you joining this conversation. Thank you so much. Right, so we come to another edition of the AgriCurious podcast, and I bet you enjoyed yourself and learned a lot from this conversation with Dr. White and Masood. Always stick with the AgriCurious podcast and tell a friend to tell a friend to tell another friend to be a part of the conversations we have here. We're available on all your streaming platforms and get to be a part of the AgriCurious family. I appreciate you being here. Once again, I'm Dennis Bafo-Iwuah, the Artistic Scientist, and I will catch you on the next episode. Be safe.